From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk about our founding fathers and their atrocious grammar. I'm kidding. It's not actually that bad. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, as they do each week, language experts and New York Times bestselling authors, Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Hello, Kathy Petras. You are there at your lovely home in Armia, Spain. I don't actually know that it's lovely because I've never been there, but I assume it's lovely.
I was just about to say that, Fletcher. That was interesting.
It is lovely. Thank you.
And the little rectangle that I can see with all of your pictures on the wall, everything looks lovely. Ross, apparently you live just amongst books. That's all you have in your rectangle.
That's true, Fletcher. I have way too many books, but actually, I don't really think there can be too many books, personally, but you can see I live by that dictum. So.
Well, before we jump in today, a little announcement. We have learned that people really like to watch podcasts in addition to listening to podcasts, or maybe instead of listening to podcasts. I don't know. This is something that people really like to do. And so with that in mind, we are now on YouTube. You can find us at You're Saying It Wrong to go and subscribe. There's no punctuation or anything in that. It's just the at symbol and You're Saying It Wrong. And if you would like to watch this podcast instead or in addition to listening to us, then you can do that each and every week now.
I will start grooming myself better.
Actually, though, Fletcher, you said we can watch it instead of listening to it, but I think they're going to listen to it while they watch it.
Oh.
Unless we should mouth it out.
No, so
we
right.
Well, they could. Captions, Ross. Come on. That's are you kidding? True. I put stuff. I always mute things and have the captions.
Oh, really? Oh, AI does it?
Yeah, so, I think okay. So. But, yeah. So who knows what it'll say that we're saying?
No.
Okay. Here we are. Few days after July 4th, but we wanted to talk a little bit about that important document for Americans, the Declaration of Independence. And as far as we all know, it's a perfect document, right? There's nothing.
Very good, Fletcher. Very good. We're going to discuss it basically in terms of the Chicago Manual of Style, which is sort of the go-to for good English in terms of writing. And we noted that it didn't really follow it that well. And maybe it's because the Chicago Manual of Style hadn't been printed yet.
Oh, you didn't make
it. Well, wait, no, Ross, actually, if I can interject, there wasn't even a Chicago yet.
Or in Illinois.
Even more so.
So we're going to forgive Thomas Jefferson for some of these lapses.
I suppose.
But now we're going to act as Thomas Jefferson's copy editors here and tell him, if he were listening, Tom, listen, that there's a few issues we do have.
It's about time.
Fletcher, we're going to take a look at the opening of the Declaration of Independence, and you're going to be in the role of Thomas Jefferson's copy editor.
Okay, okay? So four score and two. Oh, wait a minute, that's not the right. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. I don't think that was written to be read out loud.
No, it's not. It's not snappy.
I think Fletcher did a good job. I actually do. I thought it was good, Fletcher.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, so I see lots of witches that could be that's.
Fletcher, you win the Chicago Manual of Style Award of the Year. That's a really good one.
Exactly. That's one of the most important things that we noted as a mistake.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about which and that's, Fletcher?
Right. So one is, what are they called? Some kind of clause?
A restrictive clause.
Restrictive clause. There we go. And a non-restrictive clause or unrestrictive. I don't know which way that goes.
Regular clause. Yeah.
When we're talking about which, we're talking about Oh, we could take it out, right? We could basically take it out and it wouldn't change anything.
Precisely.
Yep.
Which you use when it's non-essential information added to the sentence.
And that kind of makes a difference here because, so for example, he says it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another. If we take out the which have connected them with another, then they're just dissolving political bonds.
Yeah, that's true. They should declare the causes which impel them to the separation, the other one. The causes are, there's a real reason for this. Those are those causes which impel them to do this. So in both cases, it should be that. Now, again, to be fair, as we mentioned, there was no Chicago Manual of Style back then. And interestingly enough, this distinction was fairly recent. It was coming in when Thomas Jefferson was writing this.
Oh.
He wasn't quite up to speed on that. But it was not a big deal. American English and British English. British English didn't really worry about it, and American English began to worry about it a little bit later. So he was okay with this. Is there something else you can look at? Let's don't do mankind. I mean, that we do know now. You would say humankind or whatever. But that was a style thing.
It may also reflect a little bit of their attitudes.
Yeah.
Not just the style thing.
Right.
But is there something else that strikes you when you look at it? This is like not a listening, but a looking at it.
Well, okay. Here's what I think you're getting at, is that there's lots of capital letters where we wouldn't put them.
Fletcher, again.
So let me just read this a little bit for people, obviously, who can't see this. When in the course of human events, so course is capitalized there, the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature, laws and nature are both capitalized there, and nature's God, nature again capitalized, God of course capitalized there.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just that they're capitalized sort of to emphasize?
That was the idea back then.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly enough, and this is where, again, Thomas Jefferson was a little bit behind the times. Kath and I took up the Gentleman's Magazine from the very year, 1776. And the Gentleman's Magazine was sort of the go-to magazine for gentlemen.
Gentlemen.
Yeah. The key thing was the capital letters as emphasis were going out.
Mm.
There's, Kathy and I could find earlier Gentleman's Magazines which had capitalized emphasis. By 1776, in the July issue of 1776.
June, Ross, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry,
I'm
June.
Interrupting you.
Right.
It was the June issue. So he could have read this ahead of time.
And there were none.
Wow.
I also, though, find it, what gets me, though, is, okay, the first line, when in the course of human events. Course is emphasized, but not human events.
Human events. Mm-hmm.
That's a really
Which
good
point. Seems very strange to me.
That's a good point, Kat. That got me too. I was just looking at it.
Yeah.
It's like, what in the course of human events?
Yeah. It's like okay. It's like, whoa.
Let's keep going now. Fletcher, this is sort of a question, on a two-part question. The question is, which word did Thomas Jefferson use? You'll see the choices. And then which word would be considered correct today? And then we can give you a little history of this, okay?
So here we have this sentence that I think most people will recognize it. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain rights, and I'll get back to that, certain blank rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So did Thomas Jefferson say certain unalienable rights or certain inalienable rights? To be honest, I can't just conjure that from my head, but what feels better and more like what I've heard is inalienable rights. So I'm going to go with that.
Well, it's sort of difficult because you're right and you're wrong.
Ah, of course.
He actually, in the Declaration, it says unalienable.
Uh-huh.
However, there's a debate that apparently he may have said inalienable, and then it was copy-edited by, I think, was it John Adams? Cat?
John Adams! That's the whole thing. It's so John Adams. Oh. And John Adams changed it to unalienable.
Okay.
Which I just...
So we get really complex here. And then we get to the point of this, which is interesting. Unalienable was more used up to the 1830s.
Uh-huh.
After that, inalienable has been used, and unalienable now seems very much incorrect to virtually all of us.
It seems incorrect, Ross.
And it only survives really in usage with people saying, Inalienable rights. Yeah. That's a really hard word to say, unalienable.
I was just going to say, I'm listening to you struggle with it, and I'm not laughing at you, because it's unalienable, inalienable. Is harder to say than in.
But it should be, nowadays
you would say inalienable.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So the unalienable, which is what appears in what we know as the Declaration, is actually dicey. The Chicago Manual of Style would have struck that and said inalienable.
Yes.
People, change that, please.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this now, Fletcher, is a very big deal. It's called the comma question. Did Thomas Jefferson intend to put a comma, not a period, after pursuit of happiness?
Oh. Did he mean to put a comma? All right, that among these unalienable rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, period. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, et cetera, et cetera. So you're asking, did he mean to put a period after pursuit of happiness, or did he mean to put a comma there?
Yeah.
This is a kerfuffle that came up a few years back, and people are claiming, a political scientist claims that he probably meant to put a comma in there, and that in effect, with the comma, she links the idea that the creator gives rights, that and these rights are secured by government, and that that is inalienable, that government is instituted amongst people. You see what I'm saying? In effect, government is necessary to these pursuit of happiness. I think it's really a tempest in a teapot, personally.
Yeah, it sure seems like it. I don't know exactly. I don't see a huge difference in my understanding whether there's a period there or whether there's a comma there.
I'll read it to you. She contends that the period does not belong there. It was mistakenly introduced, and it has caused a routine but serious misunderstanding of the Declaration. The historian argues that the truth that we hold is self-evident, that we possess certain natural rights, extend beyond individual rights to the idea that governments are the mean to collectively realize and protect them. I don't think it's a big deal.
I don't think it's a big deal at all. This is a case to me where someone is so into their one specific, you know, field, mm-hmm. that you find things that the average person would go, like, no, I don't know. Seems okay to me. You know? All right. I'm with Tom on this one. I like the period.
Actually, not to be a real pedant here, but I was just looking up what the professor said, and the argument is from another professor, you know, talking about it. And he goes, I don't want to soft pedal this, but. And soft pedal is spelled P-E-D-D-L-E.
Oh, wow.
Oh, well, then we cannot trust this individual at all.
It's my students would be surprised to see me soft pedal, P-E-D-D-L-E, errors in grammar or transcription. I'm not going to say the name. I think it's just
irony
a typo.
Irony alert. Irony alert.
I love it. I love it. It's like not putting on the hard sell. You're soft pedaling.
One minor point. There are a number of haths in here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also beginning to go out. Thomas Jefferson was a little bit slow on the take on that. People were starting to say has now. And Catherine, I think if you want to get the kids involved, don't say hath, say has.
He who useth hath loseth the kids.
Yes.
It actually started in about 1750. Hath started fading out. Uh-huh. So, yeah. Which is funny because I would have thought hath, you know, when you were a kid and you do your fake stuff,
oh, sure.
And you try to make it look old, and you always did half and bow and stuff. I would have thought it lasted a longer time. I wouldn't have thought 1750 it fading.
I would have gone the other way. I would have thought it faded out a lot earlier.
That's what I would have
interesting.
Thought, too.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Really?
I would have thought so, too.
Okay, this is another thing on commas. This is from the Constitution, as you'll see.
All right. So, yes, this we all know, I think, or many of us Americans know. This from the Constitution, so we've moved, I guess, on from the Declaration of Independence. So a little bit later, talking about the Constitution, the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And it reads, quote, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed.
Thomas Jefferson actually apparently according to The Atlantic in 2016, apparently wanted to get rid of one of the commas. And that one comma may make a huge difference in terms of the reading of the Second Amendment, depending on your point of view. Which comma was he trying to get rid of?
The only one I can see to get rid of that might change things is after arms. The right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed.
No, actually, he wanted to get rid of the first comma.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms.
This is the whole debate. It's like some people see those commas as saying arms ownership is only for militia service.
Mm-hmm.
Others say, no, that's not the case. So if we get rid of that first comma, I am not... Okay, Ross, now, and Fletcher, what do you guys think? Okay, Thomas Jefferson wanted to get rid of the first comma. I actually do not see that...
No, this is really political. I don't
Although
I think in both cases... I would argue in both cases, it pretty much means the same thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Or is just as open to interpretation. Maybe we should put it that way.
Ooh, very nicely said, Fletcher. Very diplomatic.
Yeah, no matter where you put those commas or whether you have them or not, it doesn't really change how vague it could be.
It's very vague. Anyway, I guess for me, if you get rid of the comma a la Jefferson in the front, then it's like the militia is necessary to the security of a free state. So then the right of the people to keep, I don't know.
I think it's the same meaning, really. I don't think it's that big of a deal. However, I want to ensure something else. Ensure a fine understanding of our Constitution. Now, Fletcher, here's another question in the Constitution.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, etc., etc. Ensure spelled I-N-S-U-R-E. Now, is your question, should it be E-N?
Yes, it should. We think. I mean, people do use them interchangeably, but yes, ensure would be better.
In normal usage, yes.
Let's talk about this. Why? I mean, I would look at this, and when I think of ensure with an I-N, I think I'm about paying insurance, right?
Yes, exactly. It's like, as do most of us.
But I've been asked plenty of times and have not really had a good answer. What is the difference? Is there a difference between ensure I-N and ensure E-N?
Ensure is more like guaranteeing something. Ensure is typically protecting against loss, typically.
However, ensure and ensure have, when you look at the dictionary, ensure, the first one of the first definitions would be ensure, and one of the first definition of ensure would be ensure, because
yeah, okay.
They're essentially fairly interchangeable.
Yeah.
Although in terms of custom, we tend to, particularly in the States, we tend to think of insure with money and ensure with wishes.
I just want to say also, this was not Thomas Jefferson. He was in France during the Constitution writing. So this is not Tom here.
No, this is probably all. James Madison.
Jim, as I call him.
I went to his house in Virginia. It was beautiful.
Oh,
anyway,
did you?
Yeah, it's really stunning. Anyway, let's go on to one other thing now. Let's look at that sentence again. There's something else that the Chicago Manual of Style may have had a problem had they been around and they've been talking to Jim Madison.
Are you saying this might be another unique? No. Wait,
I'm trying to think. Sure.
Well said. Well, good segue attempt.
Attempt. Yeah, okay.
I'll give you 2 points anyway.
Sure. We're talking about more perfect, right? Because perfect would be the ideal end state, and you can't have you don't have degrees of perfection.
Yep.
I don't have a problem with it.
I mean,
I think it's a lovely rhetorical flourish.
Yeah,
personally.
I do too. I think it's fine. Now, if he'd said more unique, that would have bothered me.
More unique would have bothered me.
I could have handled that too, because I'm easygoing.
Yeah, Clinton said something in a speech. One of the Clinton speechwriters said it probably. It was how smart the founding fathers were to come up with the expression of more perfect union. They knew it would never be perfect, he said, but they knew we could always be more perfect. We could always, I don't quite get it.
No, this doesn't make any sense.
No, that one really got me, because there was an article and they were saying how brilliantly he put it. And read this again. I was thinking about this. Just former President Bill Clinton spoke of, quote, how smart the founding fathers were to come up with the expression, a more perfect union. Now, here we go with the quote. They knew we would never be perfect, he said, but they knew we could always be more perfect.
Okay, I'm sorry. That stinks of writing to me. I hate it.
The end is, and that about sums it up. It doesn't sum it up at all to me. I'm just curious, no. do you see something with that or not?
No.
No.
I don't at all.
I think I have a real issue with it, in fact.
No, I have an issue. I agree with more unique bothersome, but more perfect sounds like, you know, partially pregnant to me. It doesn't seem to...
More perfect doesn't bother me.
I like more perfect in this instance, but I don't think we can parse it like up the wazoo. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just like, it's nice here. Okay, fine, enough. Don't you think?
I mean, we know what he meant, right? I mean, like, better.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, we do.
Closer to perfect, right? Yeah.
But I wouldn't say, like, that was a more perfect show.
No, you wouldn't say it. No, no. But as Kathy said, as a rhetorical flourish, it's nice.
Yeah. But that's it. And I don't think we have to analyze it a la Bill.
Okay, that pretty much sums up our Constitution and Declaration of Independence. So now we can move on with a question from Brianna in New Jersey.
Ah, very good.
This was an interesting one. She wrote, and I actually was wondering about this myself after I read it. Mm-hmm. I have a question for you that has plagued me for years. And it occurred to me the other night as we were binging on one of our fave Brit mystery shows, Midsummer Murders, one of mine as well. She said, why Midsummer? Not in the show, but as in the name given to the day that is considered the beginning of summer. Midsummer is always around the summer solstice, but shouldn't it be in the middle of summer? This is a mystery I hope you can solve.
Wow. I didn't know that. I didn't know that's what midsummer was.
Yeah, no, midsummer. No. Okay, the summer solstice this year was on what, June 20th, I think? June 20th?
I think it was June 20th, June 20th, 21st, somewhere around
that's,
there.
I mean,
yeah.
That's usually, okay. that is when it is, right? June 20th or 21st,
right.
Yeah.
That's the solstice, but why is that day, the first day of summer, called midsummer? And this was, I had never thought of this before, so thank you, Brianna, because this was fascinating.
I never knew that. My guess would be summer didn't always mean exactly the same thing we're talking about right now.
Fletcher, you now win the Chicago Manual of Style Historical Award. You're really racking them up today. Yeah, that's exactly the reason. Basically, you looked in Old English, you looked at two seasons, a sort of shortest summer and a long winter.
Mm. Well, yeah, it was cold there, wasn't
and,
it?
I mean, it's still kind of off because summer began sometime in April. It was basically when spring began. And in effect, the solstice, which is the longest day, comes in June. So it's like not really in the middle, but kind of nearer the middle than it was before. That's basically what happened. But it still bothers me to some degree.
Well, it's still really confusing to me. Because, I mean, mm-hmm. I agree with you. It's, okay, you've got two seasons. You really have, summer and winter. And summer is summer, spring, summer. And winter is fall, winter. Is that what we're talking about? Pretty much?
Yeah.
Those two seasons.
Yeah.
Okay, so midsummer was in the middle of what they called summer because summer had started back in April.
Mm-hmm.
So the solstice, what we call the summer solstice, was indeed the middle of their summer.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. If you count it, I started counting it, and it looks like it's sort of smudged closer to the spring. It's still kind of off, I think. I mean,
maybe
I wasn't.
They weren't counting well.
Yeah, maybe not. I wasn't around in those days, but still.
Think about it, though. You're like, you're going up to the high point, which is the longest day of the year, right? And then once you hit that, I mean, you may not technically be in the middle, but it's basically like it's the point. So that's the middle, and then you go back down.
Yeah.
And
it's all downhill.
Yep. No,
you're going to the grim winter soon. Sorry.
Okay, and we have one more thing for me. Although you might be disappointed because I think I already know the answer.
We wanted to go back to our roots, I should explain, first of all. We wanted to get back to the roots where we did the old, you're saying it wrong, where we gave you a word and forced you to pronounce it. So we thought we'd kick it off with this weird one that apparently some of us already know.
Okay, so... It looks like complete nonsense. And I'd have to admit that I don't know what it is, but I'm pretty sure I know how to pronounce it. So it's spelled E-P-E-R-G-N-E. And I can't remember exactly whether it's Epern or Apern, but it's something along those lines. Epern or Apern, E-P-E-R-G-N-E.
Well, you got it. Now, the interesting thing is, I agree. I'm with you. It was funny because Kathy knew what this was.
Oh.
And I mentioned it to my wife and she instantly knew what it was. I had no idea until several days ago what it is.
Well, so quickly, is it E or A? Epern or Apern?
It's both.
Oh.
Some people say Epern. On the dictionary, some people say Epern, Apern. Then we also found a
Epern, too.
Epern,
and then an authoritative dictionary saying it's Epernay, which is wrong, I think. Oh.
I think that sounds ridiculous.
That's nonsense.
Do you have any idea what it is, Fletcher? Now I'm really curious. So basically, you just don't go Epergne, and you're fine. You know?
if you made me guess, I'd say it was something you like wear, or it has something to do with some kind of fashion-y thing.
Well, Fletcher, if you're going to wear a table centerpiece made of silver, you're right.
One might.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a table centerpiece with your over your head, you got it right. But
no, an epern is an ornamental centerpiece, and okay. It's usually for fruit or flowers, and it's usually a big bowl, and around it you have like sticks coming out, kind of like a sun thing, where you've got the sun in the center and the little sticks coming out, and there's other little baskets or dishes mm-hmm. or candle holders. It's very ornate. It's something we always have on our dinner table here.
Do you know the origin, though? It's sort of cool, really. I didn't know this. In French, it's épargne, which is saving. And the idea is that dinner guests are saved the trouble of passing dishes because you can just sort of reach in the center and grab something out of it. You mm-hmm. see what I'm saying?
So it's kind of like a classy lazy Susan that doesn't spin.
It's a French classy lazy Susan. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I like the fact that they say now it can be used for chips, dips, or other finger foods.
I think that's pretty cool. Yeah.
I need an epern.
Although epern doesn't go with chips, really, in a sense.
Nonsense.
You could have your crudité. That sounds really fancy.
Yeah, you're right. A crudité with the epern.
No, I think ranch, like a nice little onion dip, a couple of ruffled potato chips.
Yeah, think about it, though, right? You could either have your baby carrots and broccoli on your lazy Susan, or you could have your crudité on your épergne.
Fletcher, you got it. That's perfect.
You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petrus records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petrus from his home in Toronto, Ontario, in Canada. Torrin Anderson composed our theme music, and our digital team is Beth Golay and Carly Cooper. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic, or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at kandrpetrus@gmail.com. You can also email us a voice memo of you asking it your question. You might get your voice heard on air. If you'd like to do the same thing by downloading the KMUW app, you can do that and just click the Talk to Us button. You can find all of Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.